And indeed, there's something I'm eager to do tonight. We are going to be talking with three distinguished academics who join me in this discussion about the nature of revolution. Revolution, of course, means a rapid change of government brought about by violence or the threat of violence and a sudden loss of legitimacy by the old order. But governments change in yet other ways. They change by coup d'etat, or they change by simply getting kicked out via the electoral process. Indeed, the general rule in all of life, whether with regard to a government or with regard to individual existence, is and was given by Heraclitus. All is in flow. All is flux. Everything changes. One can take the great French maxim, the more it changes, the more it remains the same. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, and disagree. In fact, plus ça change. The more it changes, the more it changes and goes on doing so. We are tonight going to ask and raise the basic question, which was raised some years ago in a great book by a Harvard historian, Crane Brinton. What is the anatomy of revolution? What's common in the revolutions? And we'll look at three or four major revolutions, the earliest being the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Bolshevik or Russian Revolution, and most recently, the Iranian Revolution. And three guests who know those revolutions quite well are with me tonight. I shall introduce them, and we'll plunge right in after the update on this evening's news from Paula Cooper.
From the Allstate Studios in Chicago, this is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
The title of tonight's program is The Anatomy of Revolution, and that's a title borrowed from a great historian. Crane Brinton was professor of history for all of his career at Harvard. That book was published in 1938. We're doing this particular conversation with the same title many, many years later. Still, one wonders whether what he had to say about the patterns by which revolutions occur and then the stages through which they go, whether that obtains and whether indeed it fits all of the revolutions that we're going to be discussing tonight. And we'll talk about four or five major revolutions of great interest to modern historians. My guests are Gary Saul Morrison, an old friend who is professor of Slavic languages and literatures at Northwestern and is inevitably expert on the Russian, or one might say the Bolshevik Revolution. John Abbott is expert on and teaches the French Revolution in the Department of History at UIC. And Ahmad Sadri is professor of Islamic World Studies and Sociology at Lake Forest College. His name might suggest to you that he is an Iranian, as indeed he is. And, of course, he's expert on that revolution through which he lived and on which he's written a great deal. I want to come directly, however, to the French Revolution. There's high drama in what we're going to be talking about, as well as a search for abstraction and generalization. Let's start with the drama, and let's ask what the drama betokens and how it occurs. What I have in mind, John Abbott, is the night of June 20th, rather the afternoon or the morning of June 20th, at the Palace of Versailles, June 20th, 1789. What happens?
Well, first we have to ask how people got to the Versailles grounds to begin with. The problem was France was basically bankrupt, and no one had a solution to that chronic fiscal problem. Questions of taxation inevitably raised political questions of representation, and then the question became who was to represent the people of France. The nobility had traditionally represented France in political matters. A logjam ensued between King Louis XVI and that nobility. No one could find a way out of it. In 1788, King Louis XVI, in a sort of Hail Mary gesture, declared for his grateful people a convening of the Estates General, right? The convocation of an old sort of quasi-medieval representative body that would somehow or other find a way out of this crisis.
A parliament of sorts which had been dead for almost two centuries.
The last time the Estates General had met had been 175 years before, and it had been convened on this old medieval principle. You have the church on the one hand, the nobility on the other, and then finally the remaining 97% of the population, the people, the so-called Third Estate, who in this scheme of things basically were powerless. So it was with great expectation that people show up at the Versailles grounds at the beginning of May. The Third Estate had its hopes raised that they were going to be able to break through and make some difference, begin to speak out on their own behalf. But those hopes were quickly dashed as they entered the hall. They were forced to wear the sort of insulting old costumes of the sort of the medieval age. There was great pomp and ceremony, and obviously no one had really thought about how to effect genuine reform in this situation. So a stalemate ensued, right? Large milling crowds of people's representatives on the grounds of the Versailles Palace over the coming weeks. And at the end, the stalemate was finally broken by some particularly bold and outspoken representatives of the Third Estate, who decided that they would convene themselves as a national assembly, right? No longer separate groups in a kingdom, but as a united voice, a united representative body to represent the French people. And they issued a challenge to the other orders, to the churchmen and the nobility: join us or be pushed aside, right? Become obsolete. And so it was that challenge that met a response from some of the more liberal churchmen of the time, some of them that went over and joined the Third Estate. And when King Louis heard of this, he was furious, and he shut the proceedings of this National Assembly in being down, right, on the morning of June 20th. Enraged with the delegates when they tried to go to their meeting places and discovered that everything had been locked down, they wandered the Versailles grounds until they came to the great cavernous tennis court. And here they met, and they declared to themselves and to the people of France that they would remain in session until they had written a constitution that would represent the people of France and its political affairs.
And they all swear to that, and that is the tennis court oath.
Exactly so.
Which really marks the beginning of the revolt of the Third Estate. And they are largely provincial lawyers and commerçants and so on, rather than nobility, of course.
They are not nobility, exactly, provincial lawyers who developed a taste for argument.
And from there, it proceeds very rapidly. The fall of the Bastille comes only a few weeks later, July 14th. Well, about three and a half weeks later, 1789, and that's marked to this day as the beginning of the French Republic, and the fall, the beginning truly of the French Revolution.
Exactly. Yeah. That is the great day of national.
Do we find, as we look at the other revolutions, and we have two others at least represented at this table at the moment, namely the Russian Revolution and the Iranian Revolution, do we find a similar stirring and a sudden surge forward in which the established government rather rapidly loses its legitimacy? Gary Morrison.
Well, in the Russian case, you really have two revolutions going on in the same
year. Yes.
In February 1917, the army has basically collapsed during World War I, which is what really did in the regime. And the Tsar abdicated under pressure as the only thing that might preserve authority. And what you get is then a whole series of governments trying to establish authority till October. And they are unable to do so, because while liberals and socialists are playing the game of parliamentary democracy, legal government, you had a group of revolutionaries actually trying to set up independent armed forces called Soviets at this point, supposedly workers' councils. And prevent anything from happening.
These are the so-called Bolsheviks.
Bolsheviks and their allies at the time. Eventually it was the Bolsheviks.
What does Bolshevik mean in Russian?
It means majoritarian, and it goes back...
But they were, in fact, a very small minority, weren't they?
Well, it's majority of what? It was a majority of the Social Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And, in fact, they weren't a majority of the Social Democratic Party, but they had a majority in one vote. Therefore, adopted the name majoritarian. To show you how foolish the other side was, they accepted the name minoritarian, even though they were a majority, which shows how bad politicians are. They were the Mensheviks.
Has the Tsar been deposed at the very beginning?
Well, the Tsar is not deposed. He abdicates.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember I used to have up on my wall the front page of the New York Times that day, and to show you how peculiarly different it looked at the time from hindsight, I remember the headline read, Revolution in Russia, Tsar abdicates, Michael made regent. Michael never did anything. Empress in hiding. Pro-German ministers reported slain. That is, from the perspective of the New York Times, this was all about whether Russia was going to stay in World War I or not.
A personal note. When I was a kid in junior high school in New York City, I went to some invited meeting in Manhattan to hear a man whose significance I then did not comprehend, but he was none other than, I think, the first premier of the democratic form of the pre-revolutionary government, namely Kerensky, who lived came to this country after the true Bolshevik Revolution of October, and for years and years and years was sort of on the socialist talking circuit around New York.
Yes, actually, right after the Tsar fell, you started with a conservative government, and then it moved to a liberal government.
Here we come very close.
Kerensky was head of a party that, in any other circumstance, would have been the flaming radicals, the socialist revolutionaries.
Yeah.
They were terrorists. They were the terrorists.
What were they called as a
socialist
party?
Socialist revolutionaries.
Yeah.
And they weren't good enough because they were sort of misty-eyed idealists, even though terrorists. And they couldn't stand up to the Bolsheviks who were, hard-nosed.
Led by Lenin, who said, we're going to take this.
They were no political match for Lenin.
Oh, I mentioned Crane Brinton as we began. And, of course, Brinton's basic characterization of all revolution is that it starts with sort of a democratic group that wants to make some peace with the established order rather than necessarily totally deface it and destroy it. But ultimately and inevitably, in the revolutionary group, the left and the radicals come to power. It may go through a transition of two or three different stages, but finally the ultimate radicals take over, and then they start killing, and they establish a very repressive regime, which ultimately may even devour their own members. That's in the French Revolution is called the Thermidor because it begins in the month of Thermidor, which has been invented as a new revolutionary calendar. We need to deal with all of this, and we need to look at Iran directly right after we pause to serve capitalism in our own feeble way with these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So far, we've touched upon the beginning of two revolutions and tried to apply Brinton's generalization about how they go from a kind of friendly early stage, even though a whole legitimate order has been delegitimated and toppled, but they tend to go towards greater radicalism, and ultimately they go towards blood. At least that was certainly true in the French Revolution. It was certainly true in the Soviet Revolution. The bloody part of the Soviet Revolution went on until the death of Joseph Stalin, quite possibly many, many years later. Let's turn to the Iranian Revolution. And Ahmad Sadri of the Department of Sociology at Lake Forest College, you are not only a teacher of and a writer about that revolution, you were there. Were you, in fact, a participant in any sense?
Well, when the revolution started, it started with a series of street demonstrations. It all started with an article in the newspaper that the Shah had commissioned questioning the legitimacy of a character named Ayatollah Khomeini, who had been exiled 10 years earlier. And there was a demonstration in the city of Qom. A few people got shot. And at the 40th day of the death of these people, people would gather, as Muslims do, to celebrate the death of these people, to remember them. And these 40th day demonstrations, each one of them got more radicalized, and until people really knew that things are changing. And eventually the Shah had to leave the country, as he would do, he had done before. He appeared to be a very powerful tyrant, but he was pusillanimous. When things got rough, he would leave the country. He left the country. He appointed a man named Bakhtiar to take care of the government. And
Leave the country in the sense that he abdicated and gave up the throne?
He didn't formally abdicate. He said he's going for a vacation.
Merely that,
and
yes.
As he had done in 1953 when the American coup d'etat brought him back, he said he went on his vacation, quote-unquote, and Bakhtiar was running the affairs, and things were getting radicalized. Ayatollah Khomeini was pushed out of Iraq at the request of the Shah. He had nowhere to go. He couldn't enter Kuwait. At a moment of desperation, A man named Yazdi, Dr. Yazdi, suggested that he go to Paris. He went to Paris, and from Paris, when he realized things are apt in Iran to change very rapidly, he decided to go to Iran. And when he went to Iran...
A moment's observation. That has sometimes been called the cassette revolution. In Paris, he recorded many speeches to the Iranians, and they were in old-fashioned cassette form. They flooded the country, didn't they?
Yes. Of course, in those days, you would call it newfangled.
Newfangled, yeah.
Cassette tapes. And I remember those days very well. The cassettes would go like hotcakes. Everybody would know the cassettes are going around. And some of the people who were distributing the cassettes were government agents, including members of the Shah's own secret police would be passing these out, because the Shah had been delegitimized so rapidly that he was losing everybody, even his own.
You know, going back to Brinton for a moment, you all remember that he says one of the crucial signs of the coming of a revolution is that members of the ruling caste, particularly younger members of the ruling caste who are sharing in some of those privileges, begin to lose faith in the government that they are supporting, begin indeed to feel that their whole social class or their social caste carries a burden of guilt, and they must dissociate themselves and oppose their fathers, so to speak.
Yeah, actually, Marx says exactly the same thing in his manifesto. So when at this particular moment, Khomeini has come into the country, Bakhtiar could not prevent him from coming, and Bakhtiar is formally in charge, and nobody knows what is going to happen until this particular day in which a branch of the army called the Home Affairs. And these are a technical corps that the Shah had brought into the Air Force to fix the airplanes and take care of the of technical issues. They really felt dissed because they had no rank, and they felt that they are very important. They are not being given the respect that they thought they should have. The Home Affairs come to the residence of Khomeini, and they march in front of Khomeini in a military style. And Khomeini, for the first time, this Ayatollah, this guy wearing a turban and loose clothes, he's standing there, and the army, these units of that look very, because these Home Affairs were never armed, but they looked very formal. They come and they march in front of Khomeini. That was the moment of paradigm shift. That was the moment that everybody winced and said, oh my God, things are changing very rapidly. So I would say that moment of Home Affairs, and after that, it was very, very rapid, and the government felt very, very fast after that day of the Home Affairs marching in front of Khomeini.
And Khomeini takes total power, or he becomes the supreme power. But one very crucial difference between the three revolutions we've already talked about emerges. That is, between the Russian and the French Revolution on the one hand and the Iranian on the other. We haven't yet brought in the American Revolution. I don't know where it stands on this dimension. The dimension being attitudes towards and uses of religion and of Orthodox religion. The French Revolution is anti-Catholic, very significantly so. And the Russian Revolution is clearly anti-Orthodox and holds religion to be the delusion of the masses in a simple Marxian way. Whereas, obviously, the Iranian Revolution is retrograde, or at least it is restorative, of Shiite Muslim orthodoxy and claims indeed to purify the whole far too westernized society, that being the work of the Shah, by returning to the signs of orthodoxy and the rituals of orthodoxy, not the least of which, indeed the most evident and obvious of which, is to alter instantly the status of women, including the very dress of women as well as their social comportment.
Yes, actually, I would say the 1979 revolution of Iran really was the spearheading of a new global situation, and that is the coming out back of fundamentalism.
Yes.
Not only in the Islamic world, but also in the Christian world. 1979 is when the moral majority declared its existence in the United States.
Yes, but they don't take over the government.
No, but it was really quite something. In America, where everything was secular, you know, in World War II ends, nobody talks of God. God has nothing to do with this. And all of a sudden, the fundamentalists come back from that have been completely absent since the monkey trials. I would say that The Islamic Revolution in Iran, of course, they took over the state, but there was something going on all over the world that resonated, and they took over.
Would our other two guests agree with Ahmad that religion had so that fundamentalist Christianity had so small and vestigial a role in the United States, say directly after World War II? I would not agree. I think
no. I think that's if you're a liberal intellectual who never encounters religious people and suddenly they make noise, you think they've come into existence. In fact, Americans have been much more religious than Europeans for quite some time.
We went through a number
of, happened to be noticed at that point.
We went through many great awakenings, which are fundamentalist revivals.
I think that's not. And what's more, many people who were in the religious right were not fundamentalists. They were, they took religion seriously. But a fundamentalist is someone who takes the Bible literally, who believes, let's say, that creation took place in 6 days, and that does not characterize.
What's the comparable situation with regard to Catholic religion, or for that matter, Huguenot Protestantism, in the French Revolution?
Well, it's a bit of a stretch. I tend to agree that something new happened in this country beginning in 1979. I think that there's always been a devout and fundamentalist or literalist religious subculture in the United States. But there's a big difference in the way the modalities in which it operated. There's a big difference between the way Billy Graham operated vis-a-vis political power and the way that Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson did so. And we're still sort of living out the legacies of I think, this rather radical departure in U.S. politics. But getting back to sort of the other topics at hand, I mean, it's
how would you distinguish a conservative religious person from a fundamentalist? Or are you using the term synonymously, which strikes me as
no? I don't, and it's an extremely complex matter, and I would hate to oversimplify that situation, and I'm afraid, given the time constraints here and what we're mainly here to talk about, ultimately that is what we're going to end up doing. But I do see something rather new, and I think it's an interesting remark to note that the sort of juncture, the worldwide juncture, and the rise of religious movements across the world.
The one thing we haven't yet turned to at all is our own revolution. We speak of that great change in the delegitimation of British presence and British authority in the colonies, and the revolution, which was an active war waged for a number of years. We call that the American Revolution.
And
when we return, we're about to pause for an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper. But when we return, I put before you this basic question. Was the American Revolution a revolution in the same sense as the other three great histories to which we've already adverted? And we will return to Gary Saul Morrison, to John Abbott and Ahmad Sadri, directly after this update from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are talking about the anatomy of revolution and considering some great revolutions in that context and seeking similarities between them and examining the differences between them. Gary Saul Morrison is professor of Slavic languages and literatures at Northwestern. John Abbott is professor in history at UIC. Ahmad Sadri is professor of sociology at Lake Forest College. One question that emerged in the last public portion of our conversation was, what is the role of religion really in revolution? And do revolutions rise from religious faith of some sort, or do they almost always work against it? Another question that has emerged during the interim while the commercials were playing is, what is the role of poverty? What is the role of prevalent dissatisfaction among the masses in revolution? Is that a necessary precondition for the making of revolution? And yet a third question is, when, what about the American Revolution? Was it a revolution? You can take all three of those to begin with, Gary, and try to juggle them together.
Well, I'll start with the American Revolution. I think people call it the American Revolution because revolution is such a nice word that we want to apply it to our country too. But in fact, there's a difference between a revolution and a war of national independence. The American Revolution is a war. It's throwing out a foreign power. It's not overturning the social order. Washington, Jefferson kept their estates. Contrast that with Russia, where the entire aristocracy was simply wiped out, where all the institutions of society, all of them, were destroyed. This is nothing like what happened. You threw out the British and killed their sympathizers. But that was the basic social order stays the same. It's not a revolution.
Touch upon the role of religion. A great continuing controversy is, were the founders true Christians, or were they, in fact, rather disabused of all of that and tending towards agnosticism?
Well, the problem with a question like that is you're asking it in anachronistic terms.
Uh-huh.
Given what we think religion is now, were they religious? And the answer is, well, some of them were religious in some sense. Most of them were deists. Some of them were atheists. They were not. Some of them were hostile to religion. Some of them were not.
Most they were
of them
surely not
some sort of God.
They were surely not fundamentalist Christians.
They were not fundamentalists, but they believed in God, and they were not hostile to religion, with a few exceptions. I mean,
yeah.
With a few exceptions, like Thomas Paine. I mean, but
he's quite angry about religion,
yeah,
to be sure. But so the proposition from Morrison is ours was not a revolution; it was essentially a war of independence against a distant but prevailing order. Does that make sense?
Well, there's a great deal of truth to it. And at the same time, it's a war of independence in which the ideas of the Enlightenment play an extraordinarily important role. These figures, the founding fathers, are enamored of the sort of the idea of rights and liberties. That's an inheritance they've taken from John Locke and others. And there are, as I would certainly agree that in social terms, it's not a revolution. The existing order is largely preserved and carried forward. But in political terms, there's a great deal of novelty, right? It's not a galvanic event in terms of European opinion. This is a distant frontier, a kind of strange and savage land. But inasmuch as people in France are aware of these events, it is enormously influential and greatly inspiring.
And of course, some of the ideas that guided our founding fathers came from France, from Voltaire, from Rousseau, and of course from England. You mentioned Locke, and one could mention various others.
Many of them are thinking of it as one more step in the British political process.
Uh-huh.
That is, you know, this is another step beyond the Glorious Revolution. This is, you know, greater representation. This is establishing our rights as Englishmen, which we've been denied because we're on the other side of an ocean.
Right.
It's thought of as, Enlightenment ideas, but those Enlightenment ideas are, after all, Voltaire was the great admirer of the British Constitution as well.
Right.
But now, pushing that other question that I raised a moment ago, is it a necessary condition, if not sufficient, is it a necessary condition that the masses need to be huddled in poverty and near starvation?
Well, I mean, take the Iranian Revolution. The Iranian Revolution followed a great improvement in Iranian economy. The military budget of Iran between 1973 and 1977 quadrupled. All the petrodollars, this is a petrolic state, all the petrodollars started to flood the Iranian market. It was a great deal
And many of them came from Israel.
Iran sold oil.
All of the oil that Israel used in those days came from Iran.
Even during the Six-Day War. There was a great deal of dislocation because of this economic prosperity. The expectations start to soar. And the actual improvement cannot keep pace with the rising expectations. The difference between expectations and reality starts to become enormous. But when things stay the same for a long time, people learn to live within those situations. So there was a great deal of dislocation. People from the villages started to come and live in the cities. The urban population grew. But there was also crony capitalism. People could also see great disparities. And all of these really fed into the idea that things are going very badly for Iranians.
I see one significant difference between the American Revolution and the other three that we focused upon. The other three do meet... again, Crane Brinton's specification that towards the end, as the elite gets more and more radicalized or gets more and more given to ferocity against those with whom they have some arguments within the revolutionary body, the revolution begins to, in the famous phrase, devour its own. The Soviets, quite early on, start killing one another. The Vendée in the French Revolution was the extermination of a large body of the peasantry, essentially, but they also in the various phases of the French Revolution begin to destroy one another. The members of the government in the different parties begin to essentially send each other to the guillotine. And a question arises as to how much of that has happened already and how much of it is yet to happen in Iran. But clearly it is the case, is it not, that nothing of that sort happens in consequence of the American Revolution, except for Alexander Hamilton being shot down by Aaron Burr in a duel.
You know, the founding fathers remain the founding fathers. Yeah. They're not killed. There's no parasite.
They become the presidents, in fact.
There is ultimately a civil war that sort of addresses unfinished business left over, having to do with some of those social circumstances, right, that has survived intact.
So maybe the reason, one indication that we're not a real revolution is we didn't devour the makers of the revolution. I hope that you can address that. I'm sure you can when we return right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Let me offer you a few quotations that are worth examination in the context that we established, or I tried to establish just a few minutes ago. Fidel Castro, and I guess he made a revolution, if you want to call it a revolution, says a revolution is a struggle to the death between the future and the past.
Joseph, which side was he on?
He's on the side of the future. Or his future. Stalin says, you cannot make a revolution with silk gloves. He probably also is the source of, you're the expert on quotations as well, Gary. Didn't he also say you can't make a revolution, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs?
Actually, that was a very common expression. We usually associate it with Walter Duranty.
Oh, really?
Who was, you know, the main New York Times correspondent, a close friend of Stalin and his apologist.
And who justified the death... The purge trials in the 1930s.
And won several Pulitzer Prizes for doing so.
To be sure. Power, George Orwell, power is not a means. It is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship.
Well, that's not Orwell. That's O'Brien in 1984. That's his character.
That's a quotation,
that's
isn't
from
it?
From O'Brien at the end
from
of 1984.
From 1984. Yes, makes good sense. Yes, I think you must be right. Is the regression to violence and the consummation of one's own children, so to speak, the makers of the revolution begin to devour the other makers of the revolution, leading ultimately to a failure of the revolutionary intention and to a new kind of dictatorship which is destructive of the supposed ideals of the revolution, is that visible in the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Iranian Revolution? Look at the French
yes,
to begin with.
I think it is, but I think for rather different reasons. What the common denominator, it seems to me, that we have in all these situations is, you have this crisis within the ruling circles themselves, amongst the governing classes. They can't rule in the old way. A great breach is opened up in national political life, and people fill that breach in one way or another, speaking in the name of the people. But which people? Right, that becomes the question, and what is the aim? What is the goal? And it's in the heat of that struggle, right, that people try to come up with new legitimating principles upon which a new order can be built. The French revolutionaries were starting from scratch, right? Their models went back to Greece and particularly the old Roman Republic, but mainly they were making it up as they went along. What mainly fueled the activities of the crowd in the French Revolution were hunger and fear. That was what drove the Parisian crowds. They were hungry, they wanted bread, and they were fearful that their own revolution would be drowned in blood, right? That they would come up.
And after so much blood has been shed, something else emerges, the Committee on Public Safety.
Exactly.
One of whose members is an interesting military officer named Napoleon.
Oh, no, no. He
emerges later.
He
goes and messes up Italy for them on orders as a general, very young general. But ultimately, he emerges as, in essence, the dictator of France.
Well, I think that's an interesting common denominator also here. I mean, it takes us to that. all of these revolutions introduce the problem of popular participation. You've let the genie out of the bottle. You've got people deliberating in their own name on their own behalf. And yet the result is chaos and instability. How do you restore order to that situation? And what Napoleon does and what the armies of the French Revolution do is they create a new form of participation in which people can play the role of heroes, but within a rigid command structure, right? In which questions of democracy are no longer particularly important. So you have Napoleon in the case of the French Revolution. You have the Iran-Iraq War, right? In the case of the Iranian Revolution, and I think you have similar, it's a little bit different in the Russian case, but certainly the Civil War and the building of the Red Army also, it seems to me, represents a sort of channeling of these energies, right, into more socially stable forms.
Just last night on this program, we discussed the War of 1812, which one could also say is a reverberation from the American Revolution, but in it, only some 5,000 Americans were killed, and it only lasted a year and a half. And agitated the Canadians for a while, but essentially it was a draw. And since then, things have been rather pacific on the Canadian border. And we haven't done any other. Well, of course, we had the Great Civil War, which is the internal devastation. In the case of the Soviet Revolution, it seems to me a great war was waged against the Russian people.
Well, yeah, I think if you're looking at it from perspective of the Bolsheviks, it wasn't that the idealism got taken over or betrayed. The idea was to establish a hard dictatorship. And what I think of as liberal idealism was just so much window dressing, you know, to work temporarily. It was very clear, you know, from the Bolsheviks what they wanted to do. And they wanted to establish a rule of a very small group, not like the Mensheviks, who wanted a mass party. They wanted a very small, you know, dictatorship, which would have a new form of power which had never existed before, which we now call totalitarianism, which would control every aspect of life. And that was very clear from the beginning. All the rest was intermediate steps for the people whom Lenin called useful idiots to believe.
But Gary, in their theology, that is, in their political ideology, even as elaborated by Stalin in some of his writings, and even as elaborated earlier by Lenin and Trotsky, I suppose, the ultimate vision was that they would build socialism to move towards true communism. And in true communism, you would know you had arrived when the state, quote, withered away. Did they believe that?
You know, they believed it in the way that the Catholic Church today believes that someday there'll be a second coming. In the meantime, we need police, a lot of them, you know. That's how they believed.
Yeah.
You know, it was. You know, remember that when Stalin gains power, he proclaims the intensification of the class struggle. There was no enemies, but that's precisely why you had to make enemies. That the state had to be based on continual violence.
He pronounces,
that's what that passage from Orwell is precisely alluding to. The idea that even when you have no enemies, you have to make them because the state works by creating.
At one point in the 1930s, Stalin announces proudly, "We have achieved the elimination of the kulaks as a class," meaning sort of landed peasants of some small wealth. They got a cow or two. In fact, they eliminated the kulaks as a class by eliminating the kulaks. In the Ukraine, they managed to kill off, through starvation, some 3 to 5 million people.
That's be a conservative estimate.
Yeah, others have estimated higher.
I have a question about the quotation. Is it true that Trotsky said that in the communist state, things will be so great that people, rather than speaking, they would express themselves in songs and poetry?
He said something like that, not exactly that. He thought that what would happen, he believed in the doctrine of the leap from the kingdom of necessity to the kingdom of freedom, which meant that instead of, didn't mean freedom in our sense, that the laws of nature controlled people, people would dictate to the laws of nature. That means that they could evolve into a much higher species. So within a few years, he thought the average Russian would have the intelligence of Shakespeare, and the final sentence of his book ends, "And above that, new peaks will rise." So Trotsky actually believed this. I'm not sure Stalin believed this, but there's no doubt Trotsky believed this sort of thing.
Was that why he had to be killed?
No, I don't think that's why he had to be killed. He was just a rival for power who lost, you know. Yeah. He wasn't as good at manipulating.
He wound
power.
Up with an axe in his head, delivered by a Stalinist assassin.
Stalin was very good
in Mexico City.
Ice pick.
Was it an ice pick rather than an axe?
An ice pick, yeah.
Take all of this to Iran. I think we're dealing here with a surge or a longing for freedom, which arises sooner or later, particularly when material benefits have been sufficiently distributed so that people aren't starving all the time. They ultimately, and if they get some education and some technology, they begin to long for more and more freedom in the sense of being allowed to express opinion and act upon opinion and upon value preference. Surely that is the case even now in Iran. Or do I misperceive?
No, it is true that there was a great disenchantment that set in very, very close to the time of the revolution and in several waves. Of course, as John was saying, the 10-year Iran-Iraq war really kept that reign of terror and virtue very much alive. Although not a lot of people comparatively got killed, a few people were killed initially, but that the war really kept the revolutionary spirit up. When the war ended, there was a direct falling off of that revolutionary zeal, and Iran entered under Mr. Rafsanjani another decade of quote-unquote reconstruction. That was basically Iranian Thermidor or something like that. And the idea was that, okay, well, the war is over, now we are consolidating. What actually came out of that was not a lot of reconstruction, but crony capitalism from hell. And during the second
period... Hold on, what do you mean by crony capitalism
Mr. Rafsanjani wanted to liberalize the economy, but keep the political system closed. And when you can't have capitalism when there is no free flow of information. So information was restricted to a few people who got enormously rich very, very rapidly. And
instead of being efficient, you had government connections to get here.
Exactly. And this is actually the repetition of what Iran was under the Shah. Iran was a rentier state. And actually, in Iran, one of the new words that is very prevalent in Iran is the word rent. The capital is not what you have in the bank. The capital is the people that you know and will allow you to use the government benefits in order to create wealth. And this is the idea of the new class in Eastern Europe that revolution that sociologists developed. And so basically, Iran was a rentier state during the Shah, and it continues to be that. The capitalism in Iran is greatly hampered because you can't have capitalism without democracy, basically.
You can't have it without the rule of law, but you can have it without democracy.
True.
You have to have a legal system, property rights, and free speech, but you don't have to have voting.
Right. It is true. Iran, the main obstacle in Iran, I think, is the restrictions on the press and the restriction on the news and information. And the information is power. And another problem, as you pointed out very correctly, is the opaqueness of the legal system in Iran. Nobody really knows what the rules. It's the most unpredictable thing in Iran to predict how the laws are going to treat capital or treat actually anything. It's
what does one make valuable. Of what does one make of the rise of, or at least the public prominence of Ahmadinejad, and what is the ultimate? Just the other day, there was a major article, I guess, in the Weekly Standard, the cover story about Khamenei, who is seen to be the ultimate leader and the man of ultimate power, but a rather disappointing and rather stupid person, according to the writer of that article. What is the power structure in Iran right now?
Okay, very good.
Are they holding back a popular rejection of the whole revolution now that it has gone on and produced some real disorder and chaos over 30 or 40 years?
Okay, in the last 35 years, the first decade is the Iran-Iraq war and the continuation of the revolutionary spirit. When that war ends, rather disappointingly, there's a great moment of disenchantment, and a lot of people of the cadre elite of the revolution have a great moment of realization. A light goes on in their mind that they have been fighting for 10 years for a delusion, because Khomeini said, we will never end this war and we will never make, unless in victory, and we'll never compromise with Saddam Hussein, we'll never accept United Nations declarations, and indeed that's exactly what he did. So when the actual reconstruction period is going on the Rafsanjani, underneath this, there is the reform movement that is brewing. So the reform movement takes over in 1997 with the two-term presidency of Khatami. And the reformers come and they try to introduce a new Islamic revolution with a human face, so to speak.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they fail for a variety of reasons that we don't have to the time to go into now. Khatami fails. Some of his failures are personal and the others mm-hmm. are structural. And Ahmadinejad is the neo-revolutionary movement of Iran. It happens in other revolutions as well. After a while, some people come and say, oh, we have betrayed the ideals of revolution. And they try to reuse the unused ammunition of the revolution. And Ahmadinejad was that. And this was very, very brief.
But he's still there, and Khamenei is still there. And
but remember, Ahmadinejad's day was over. After the first term, he would never be re-elected.
Yeah, one has read that.
They actually engineered his new victory in 2009.
A great question, I just pose it. We have to go to the newsroom in just a moment, is will that regime fall? Will it fall to a kind of a democratic rejection apparently, they almost lost an election the last time around, and they repressed it with some killing in the streets. Is that an augury of things to come? We will return to Gary Saul Morrison, to John Abbott and Ahmad Sadri directly after an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
From the Allstate Studios in Chicago, this is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
This is one of those nights when the talent around the table is so good and there's so much to talk about that we will not get to the phones until after the 11:30 break. But I promise we will directly thereafter turn to your calls. If you are eager to pose a question and don't mind waiting a bit, and if you can forgive my throat clearing, you can get your call in right now. The number, of course, is 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And to our internet listeners at some greater distance in the country or elsewhere in the world, if you want to get in with a question, the best way, of course, would be via email, and the email address extension720@wgnradio.com. extension720, as one word, at wgnradio.com, or the aforesaid 312-591-7200. I want to get to something else shortly, but before we do, it occurs to me there's an interesting leftover question in the air since we've been talking a good deal about Iran. I must ask you, Ahmad, and then ask John and Gary to respond to you. I must ask you this basic question. What are they really up to with regard to nuclear weapons? What are they really up to with regard to their intentions toward Israel and, more broadly, their intentions towards the rest of the Arab world, that is, the Muslim Middle Eastern world, at least? Are they a danger to the rest of us, or are they not?
Well, first of all, about the Arab Spring, Iran has lost a great deal of its popularity in the Arab world after the Arab Spring. Iran used to be the only great hope on the horizon, given the corruption that beset all the Arab countries, and Iranian President Ahmadinejad loved to preen himself as the only one who speaks truth to power, be it United States or Israel. Now, because of these revolutions, Iran has lost a lot of its cachet and its spiritual power in that part of the world. Regarding the nuclear issue, I think, and I've always believed that that's a red herring, and Iranians are basically are going for nuclear energy. Of course, managing nuclear energy will give them the cachet and the popularity, the emblem of being able to go nuclear should they want to do so. Any country who has mastery of nuclear cycle and has peaceful nuclear energy can go nuclear if they want. Such as countries such as Korea or Japan or Brazil are examples of this. But I don't think they're going to develop a nuclear weapon. I don't think they're going to threaten anybody. I think that is mostly a manufactured fear.
And what about all of the anti-Israeli pronouncement and all the threats, all the speeches about how we must expunge Israel and destroy it as a Jewish state? Is that merely rhetoric?
You never heard that from Mr. Khatami. That is part of the Ahmadinejad's bluster, and that's part of the way in which he makes himself enfant terrible of the world. He loves to appear in that role. And by the way, what he says is nothing new. Khomeini said everything that he has already said, and Israel managed to ignore all of that. Everything that Ahmadinejad is saying had already been said by Khomeini. But Ahmadinejad loves this role because he wants to show off the liberals that preceded him and distinguish himself from them. Most of it is show, and there is no substance to these threats.
How can you be so sure? I mean, just suppose you're wrong, which is possible because you don't have, you know, direct access.
No, I don't.
So if you're wrong, the danger is so enormous of nuclear weapons of people who say they want to use them to destroy another state. Doesn't it pay to be prudent and assume, well, maybe not, but maybe?
Right. I think that's a very fair question to ask. Look, Iran, these people who are in Iran, the clerics who are in power, they are clerics after all. They are conservative. They don't want to die in a nuclear disaster. Iran, even if Iran manages to manufacture one or two nuclear weapons, Iran will be a nuclear wasteland before even it tries to use it against Israel. Israel has a huge arsenal of hundreds of nuclear weapons, and Iran will never use this on Israel, killing and destroying Palestinian and Islamic lands, and in the meanwhile committing suicide. That really makes no sense. And by the way, Iran, even Ahmadinejad and Iranian right wing have never threatened to use nuclear weapons on Israel. And what they have said, again, as what Ahmadinejad said, the worst thing that he said is what already said by Khomeini, that Israel as a political entity should disappear. They never talked about exterminating anybody.
Well, I think the interesting point that was made at the beginning by you was that Iran's profile and political prominence in the region has weakened enormously in the wake of the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And we see the situation in Syria right now developing in ways that are further going to backfire against much of the Iranian leadership if they play their cards in the way that they seem to be playing. And it seems to me that gets us back to a question about revolutions to begin with. And much of the discussion about revolutions tonight has been pejorative, and we've been sort of focusing on the downside and the terrible consequences that ensue.
The only really good revolution we've talked about so far is the American Revolution, which Gary tells us wasn't really a revolution.
But my point is this, is that revolutions sometimes are necessary. The French Revolution was not made by the revolutionaries. The French Revolution was made by a breakdown of the Ancien regime. And then people had to try to figure out a way to put the pieces back together again.
But you agree there might have been a better way.
There wasn't. People tried reform. King Louis ultimately dug his own grave in the French Revolution.
How do you know there wasn't a better way?
My point is this. Okay, people find themselves in situations where the political system has proven itself chronically incapable of reform, and sometimes those systems break down in ways that create mass suffering and misery. And when people try to do something to better their situation, I don't blame them, and I think there's something very positive about that impulse, and it doesn't always lead to bad things. Most of us would celebrate what people did in Europe, Eastern Europe in 1989. Those two were revolutions, and I don't hear anybody talking about the downside of the terrible consequences of those actions.
They were not revolutions in Eastern Europe.
This,
they drove out the Russians. It's, again, driving out a foreign power.
This is not what happened. In East Germany. This is not what happened in Czechoslovakia. Those were political revolutions. The old order crumbled.
The old order was held in by Soviet troops. It never had any popular support. The moment the Soviets indicated they were not going to support these regimes, they were dead. It had nothing. It was purely a Soviet
army that was keeping these regimes in power.
My original point was this.
This has nothing to do with the revolution.
People find themselves having to rise up in revolution. That is a circumstantial situation. Some people come out of that stuck, frozen in that posture. And in order to maintain their power, they sustain that revolutionary mentality in a way that constantly creates enemies, right? So as to maintain their grip upon power. In other words, revolutions lead to different outcomes. There are forks in the road. There's no inevitability to their outcomes. Some of them move back to a situation of more or less normalcy. Others, again, remain under the leadership of people who, in order to maintain their power, distort the political situation, create enemies, and constantly mobilize people in incessant campaigns against them. Just as Stalin needed his Trotsky, so does Ahmadinejad need his Israel. It's the same logic. It's the same principle, right? And that
but it's not the same number of casualties. However bad the czars were, you can number their executions
Stalin.
In the
I'm
hundreds.
Stalin.
The number of Stalins are in the tens of millions. The problem with, yes, the czarist system broke down, but to think that because one system broke down, a revolution will make it better is to ignore
that.
The history of the 20th century. The revolution makes it much worse by the order of millions.
Well, the problem is whatever we say about it, that was not the view of the Russian people at the time.
It wasn't the Russian people. It was a handful of armed Bolsheviks.
You also established that before the Bolshevik Revolution, there was a provisional revolutionary government. It was, in some ways, the most democratic popular uprising that had occurred across Europe since the time of the French Revolution.
We have reached...
Outcome is an entirely different matter, but to negate that democratic impulse is simply wrong.
We've reached a true difference of opinion, which is a rarity around this table, but it's always delightful. Just to lighten it just a bit, even the French Revolution perhaps didn't fully succeed. The ultimate comment might have been that of de Gaulle, who said, how can you possibly rule a nation that has 373 cheeses? And with that, we'll pause and take care of some overdue commercials. I've got a leftover question, of which I will spring upon you right after we pause for this.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
The leftover question I had in mind, we could, of course, do, and we have in the past done a full program on it, is the rise of fascism, particularly in Italy in the 20s and in Germany in the 30s. There were other lesser fascist movements in Europe, as we know. Can they also, Gary Morrison, be seen as following... somehow the dynamic of revolution?
Well, sure, depending on which one. I mean, fascism is such a loose term.
Yeah. Well, look at Nazism particularly and the rise of Hitler.
Well, I think you could call that a social revolution that, you know, established a radically different sort of society, and had it succeeded...
Out of a democracy, a democracy in serious economic trouble, but a democracy that really was styled in the Western fashion.
Well, a very weak one that had barely existed at all in a country with no democratic tradition. That's a good way to have, you know, either communists or fascists take over. I mean, because there's no real strong roots of democracy. And then you can vote the democracy out, which is...
Does Hitlerism follow those stages elaborated by Brinton? Does that revolution devour its own? To be sure, early on, Hitler killed the leadership of the Sturmabteilung, the SA, and Sturm and those others. But otherwise, they weren't destroying themselves, were they?
Well, you didn't have a period where there was a power vacuum. Hitler was in control pretty much
from
the
beginning. Yes.
And what makes the dynamic that drives you to more and more radical positions is a power vacuum, which you did have in Russia and you did have in France. And I think you had in Iran, but you did not have in Germany. And that was it. Perhaps if Hitler had lasted long enough to die, he might have had it. But
well, does it then follow that stable democracies, if they've been around for 100 or 200 years or longer, don't give way to to revolutions that are bound to turn authoritarian? Do we have any evidence of a more or less working democracy that's been there for a while, which has collapsed in the face of a revolution that took dictatorial form? I think not.
I'm not coming up with anything. No.
I don't know. What about Argentina under...
Argentina? You have those putches. You have those coup d'etat, in South America, where democracies are tumbled by officer corps. That's true. Though they don't last.
They don't last.
Right.
No.
They're thinly based, and by and large, the military goes back to the barracks and a restoration of some kind of representative government. So...
Gary, how do you respond to the theory that fascism is actually Marxism, socialism, transvalued?
It's too general. It is, you know, Marxism in the sense that it has government control over the economy, and if you're thinking of Nazism, that it's a form of totalitarianism. Obviously, it's appealing to very different sorts of values, right? Communism appeals to radical equality, to classes. The role of class in a Nazi regime is taken by race, right? And so you're killing, you know, racial enemies as opposed to class enemies, and that presents a kind of different cultural atmosphere. So there are some similarities and some differences.
That is a transvaluation. You remember in that movie, Leni Riefenstahl's movie, Triumph of the Wills, there's a great scene where people are standing up, holding, instruments of laborers, and they're all declaring that this is my gun, this is my this is my instrument of implementing the will of the nation, and there is no difference between me and a soldier. So there's kind of a bringing together all the workers and the soldiers.
Well, the great theme in fascism, Italian as well as German fascism, was the so-called organic state. Pareto. Yeah. Elaborates that as really a sociologue philosopher who is in some sense an apologist for Italian fascism, that it is not the person, it is the state that is the significant unit upon which God smiles. If the state with all its component individuals perform properly in terms of their obligation rather than merely in pursuit of their separate wills. And exactly the same is said, it seems to me, maybe as early as Lenin, but surely during the Stalinist era. That's their way of conceiving the relation.
Not the state, it's the party.
The party,
and not
all right.
The nation, but the working class. You see, I mean, structurally, they turn out to lead to very similar power structures.
Yeah.
But the values in which it's done, the name is different.
Uh-huh.
And that tends to affect, you know, the cultural manifestations. It doesn't make it any nicer, but it makes it different.
Have we reached the point in our deliberations where maybe it does begin to emerge that revolutions really don't work very well? The American one being an exception, but then it's not necessarily really a revolution, and the French being an exception, but an awful lot of blood was spilled until we got to the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Republics, though now it is clearly a stable a democratic order. But does it follow from what you've all been sort of agreeing on, that basically salvation lies in the direction of establishing stable democratic orders, and without that, tumult and disorder and destruction will sooner or later follow when one aspires to social perfection, but aspires through revolution and ultimate dictatorial intention?
Right. Actually, that is the general conclusion that seems to be what has been drawn in Iran. Iranians did have a genuine revolution once, and nothing good came of it. And right now they are sick and tired of this particular regime that is dominating them despite their will, and there is no way out of it. The only way appears to be revolution, and Iranians really don't want to go that way because they have seen that nothing good comes out of a revolution. So in a way, they're kind of looking at Arab Spring wistfully and kind of with a sense of self-deprecation of why can't we do what the Syrians are doing or what the Libyans did. But again, you know, when you look at these things, you know, what will come out of this? In Syria, basically, one of the things that is happening is a great sectarian war that is probably going to take over the Middle East, the Shiite-Sunni divide. There are these many of these people who are in charge. They're great fanatics, and God knows what will happen in Syria between Shiites and Sunnis, and then in Lebanon and in Gulf countries. So these revolutions have their seamy side, and although they are heroic and they are attractive to the youth, people who have been close to it or people who have experienced one, they don't want to have another one, and that seems to be the quandary right now in Iran.
Gentlemen, we're about to pause for an update on the news, but before that, it is time to quite urgently call for telephone calls, because we want to go directly to that after the newscast. 312-591-7200 is the number. I see most of the lines are available right now. Move quickly, and you may very well get through. If you don't, but rather hit the busy signal, try again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. But if you move right now, you will get through, whether with question or with comment. 312-591-7200. 7,200. A fair amount of email has already arrived. But for our listeners around the world, if you want to come in with a comment or a question, the best way is with email. Email address extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And again, the phone number 312-591-7200 to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Murder charges are expected to be filed in the morning on two 18-year-old suspects in the shooting death of a former St. Louis University volleyball player. Police say, based on the evidence they have, they believe they have the killers of Megan Boeken. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency announced it will strip Lance Armstrong of his unprecedented 7 Tour de France titles after he was declared he was finished fighting the drug charges. USADA's chief executive says Armstrong would also be hit with a lifetime ban on Friday. A California-based hospital chain has agreed to pay $16 million to settle allegations that its hospitals were involved in a kickback scheme in which homeless people were taken to hospitals for sometimes unneeded treatment. Government programs were then billed for the work. A man from the Chicago area is arrested for threatening to kill family members of film producer Harvey Weinstein and 4 other people. Police say 25-year-old Vivek Shah sent letters with threats to kill if they did not wire money to a bank account. The FBI says 34-year-old Daniel Mack of Tinley Park is charged in the robbery of a Fifth Third Bank branch in West Chicago, plus he's a suspect in 3 other robberies. The FBI says family members of Mack came forward after seeing surveillance photos. Sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
More cars, more trucks, less bucks. Get a big-time deal with a small-town feel at Antioch Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram.
Antioch Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram has dropped prices on everything during the final sell-off of the summer clearance event. Every new 2012 model is clearance priced. For just a limited time only, save $12,000 off MSRP on select models. Or get 0% financing for 72 months. And we'll pay more for your trade than you ever thought possible. But hurry, it all ends August 31st at Antioch Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram on Route 173 or online at AntiochChryslerDodgeJeep.com. Nobody sells for less. Nobody.
Get a big-time deal with a small-time feel at Antioch Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram.
On select models to qualified buyers with approved credit, $1,389 per thousand finance. Rebates in lieu of financing, all incentives apply. Savings based on new 2012 Ram 2500 SLT Crew. MSRP $53,075. Add tax, title, license, and doc fee.
Baseball is better with history.
Here's the windup and the pitch. Good! A miss, strike three. Runny strikeout for Terry Wood.
Baseball is better with one vision.
Play this game like it's the seventh game of the World Series every day.
Baseball is better when homers hit Waveland.
Deep left field, get out the tape measure, long gone. Waveland Avenue and the Cubs lead 2-1.
Baseball is better with 40,000 on deck. Baseball is better without ketchup.
Get your hot dogs here.
Baseball is better with white flags.
Back to the wall, gone! Cubs win 2-1, it's all over.
Cubs baseball. Baseball is better here.
On Saturday, September 1st at 12:05, the first 10,000 fans will receive a luggage tag compliments of United Airlines. Get your tickets at Cubs.com and get there early for all the fun at Wrigley Field.
Stopped out by a temporary spike? Well, then try the new and simple way to trade the markets with Nadex. On Nadex, your trade stays open even if the market spikes against you, and your risk is always capped. Nadex is a Chicago-based exchange subject to regulatory oversight by the CFTC that allows you to trade directly on the exchange. The products are unique and unavailable anywhere else. See how it works at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Futures and options trading involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors.
In sports, Cubs and Sox took the day off. Cubs take on the Rockies tomorrow. Pre-game at 12:45. First pitch 1:20. Sox take on the Mariners. WGN Traffic, Ted Novak.
We have major problems along I-90, the Adams Tollway westbound. This is as you travel between Elgin and Rockford. We have ongoing, well, it's not ongoing, it's every single night road work in that stretch between Elgin and Rockford. Now, westbound I-90, we have this accident involving a motorcycle at Beverly Road. Traffic was already down to one open lane, so all lanes blocked off. Westbound I-90 at Beverly Road because of this accident involving a motorcycle. motorcycle. No traffic is getting through. Eastbound, as you head towards Elgin, you're probably seeing a delay not only with the road work, but also with gapers to the westbound activity. Now, if you're traveling on the Kennedy, not bad. There is road work in the left lane each way just north of downtown, but a brief delay. Should have those express lanes still open for outbound travel, scheduled to reverse them inbound sometime this hour. Inbound Edens is stacked up at Devon with road work in the two right lanes, 25 from Lake Cook. Outbound fine, just the left lane blocked at Devon. Eisenhower, watch for work in the left lane each way between Austin and Mannheim. Stevenson quiet. Now we're getting reports of a crash outbound Dan Ryan near 95th. Looks like it's off to the right shoulder. Bishop Ford fine, 57 southbound work in the right lane approaching I-80. Tri-state, numerous lane closures and some delays because of it each way between 95th Street and I-90. Northbound also a right lane closed north of Willow. Southbound at the Wisconsin state line, two right lanes are blocked. I-80 westbound jammed at Central with the two left lanes closed, and eastbound 80-94 left lane blocked at Broadway. Ted Novak, WGN Traffic Central.
The WGN 5-day forecast, meteorologist Al Williams.
Overnight, partly cloudy across Chicagoland. Low temperatures ranging from 65 well inland to 75 downtown. Friday, partly sunny and hot, highs lower 90s. Friday night, partly cloudy, lows 68. Saturday, mostly sunny, high 93. Sunday, partly sunny, showers and thunderstorms likely in the afternoon, high 84. Monday, showers and thunderstorms early, then partly sunny, high 81. I'm meteorologist Al Williams in the WGN Weather Center.
O'Hare 76, Midway 80, Rockford 73, Chicago's Lakefront 80. Next news update, midnight or whenever news breaks. I'm Paula Cooper on the Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And with a particularly distinguished panel tonight, all of them very articulate and very well informed, and even managing to disagree at one or two points, which is always all the more, makes the program all the more interesting. Those guests are Ahmad Sadri, who is professor of Islamic World Studies and of Sociology at Lake Forest College, John Abbott, who's professor of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Gary Saul Morrison, who's professor of Slavic Language and Literatures at Northwestern University. Our phone number, 312-591-7200. Lines are still available, and I look forward to some good calls from our regular listeners who call on occasion, or for those who've never done so before but now have something of a real interest to ask or something of real interest to declare. We look for opinion as well as for a query. 312-591-7200, and we go to our first caller. Larry is on the air. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, Milt, you know, we talk about revolution, and your Islamic guest talked about ultimate revolution, right?
Yes.
Revolution is either the state against the revolution or either one going to eradicate the other. But when you hide it by the behind the guise of religion, is that different?
Well, it's true that the other revolutions we've talked about were not conducted in or were not rationalized by reference to a return to the true faith. They eschewed...
I understand that, but if you hide your revolution behind the guise of religion and you can't touch the religion because I'm blaspheming you, where's the advantage to either the state or the revolution?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Let's get some response to it. Ahmad.
Larry, all the revolutions that we have talked about, they have occurred behind an ideology. The ideology of the Islamic Revolution was not to establish a religious dictatorship, although more or less it is what has happened. But initially, the Islamic Revolution wanted...
Sir, hold still for a moment. You must let's get some more commentary before you respond.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, the Islamic Revolution's ideology was neither East nor West, neither capitalism nor socialism. Islam has all the solutions. Islam has all the answers. We are going to establish the heaven on earth. We are going to have a prosperous state that is not dependent on foreign governments, and it's going to be independent of these forces.
But when religion is the government, what's the difference?
What's the difference between what and what?
He says, when religion is the government, what's the difference? In other words, this is might well say, a theocracy.
Yes, of course. What turned out to be was that the Islamic Revolution became a theocracy. But initially, the slogans of the Islamic Revolution was not to establish a theocracy. It was freedom, independence and an Islamic republic, not an Islamic theocracy. The fact that it turned into a theocracy and it what we have in Iran is a combination of democratic institutions and untouchable theocratic institutions and quite unique form of government in the world, it's beside the point. The very fact initially was that this was a revolution, a genuine revolution based on the ideas of Islam, but it was going to be democratic. Khomeini in Paris said that it was going to be democratic. Everybody was going to be free. And the fact that it didn't turn out exactly like that does not affect the initial theory that this was going to be a genuine democratic and
but is it not of some special interest that doesn't need to be noted that severe modern Islamism of the Wahhabist or of the Salafi variety, which is proclaimed by some governments, aspires ultimately to remake the world into one great caliphate. It aspires to spreading Islam as the basic rule, as well as the basic religion, all over the world. To be sure, clerics probably say that with tongue-in-cheek or with private reservation, but they announce that that is the intention, not
why
of all...
Why do you assume it's tongue-in-cheek, Milt? I mean, why?
I can't imagine that...
Again, I'm looking, you know, at the Soviet example. They were...
They really believed it.
They believed in communism. It wasn't tongue-in-cheek.
For the world.
And for the world. And I don't see why. It just seems to me that Islamism plays the role
that
socialism played in Russia.
Even the Islamism, say, of the Muslim Brotherhood, now more or less in command in Egypt? Or are you talking only of the Shiite hierarchy in Iran?
Talking about some of the ones who really, you know, the ones you mentioned, the Salafists and the Wahhabis.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a matter of degree, which one, just like there were socialists and communists.
Mm-hmm.
The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has really greatly modified itself.
So they
tell us. Muslim Brotherhood 30 years ago is very different from what it is today. And Muslim Brotherhood that is in power in Egypt is actually in the manner of Islamism of Turkey that is entirely compatible with democracy. It is not in the manner of Salafis and extremists and fundamentalists.
I see John Abbott nodding in agreement, are you?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, at least the evidence so far suggests that the Brotherhood has opted for a more pluralistic approach to politics. And
let's go to the next caller. Robert joins us. Good evening, sir.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I just kind of heard that the people saying that the American Revolution wasn't a true revolution, but I think it's probably the only true revolution because it was a dignity that was – the revolution was for dignity based on the individual – whereas the European revolutions seem to be more of a tribal type of revolutions that they begin to tear down what they consider artificial, the relationships of the nobility and the religious prelates as a type of almost like an iconoclasm that they tear it down and then they have to restore it with their own artificial, like an ad hoc national something to replace this that they tore down. And it's probably also true that, say, in Iran, where the Shah was considered sort of an out of step with his country because of his domestic and international policies, that this was almost a rebellion of the Iranians to restore to some form of Iranian nationalism. You know?
Well, there are distinctions worth further clarification or further examination. John Abbott.
Well, I agree. There was a creative side to the French Revolution. The old structures of the French kingdom no longer functioned particularly well. Again, the way in which the political system was set up, in as much as there was any representation at all, 97% of the people were completely frozen out of any active voice in their government. In order to overthrow that system, ultimately both crown and altar were pushed aside and new ideas and new organizing principles took their place. Foremost amongst them, the idea of the nation, right, of the French nation, right, represented by a single unified national assembly. You're quite right. There was elements of artifice involved in constructing a new kind of iconography and ritual. There were a lot of very destructive and, in retrospect, perhaps foolish conflicts involving religion and secularism. But out of it, certainly, something more real and something that was much more sustainable emerged, right? And it led to an enormous release of energies amongst the French people, not all of which were for ill.
I think we've come to a consensus that at least two revolutions were more or less successful in the long run, though they cost a great deal, namely the American and the French. Though I think Gary will still hold to the position that ours was not a revolution in the classic sense, but rather a war of independence.
Yes, I mean, our caller said it was the true revolution because it established freedom of the individual. And if you want to define revolution as something that leads to a good result, you can do that. But I'm thinking of a revolution not trying to get up a objective definition of revolution, which is, you know, certain that involves, you know, overturning of the social order, you know, by methods of violence, not something which leads to something we like. That's why I'm saying, you know, it's not a revolutions don't produce anything good, because once you start using violence, the people who are good at violence take over and they will drive it to a solution where you have a rule of force.
But why did that not happen here? After all, the people who preferred violence and were ready to use violence did take over. One must remember that in the American case, there was a large number of loyalists who simply left the country. They went to Canada. They became Canada, in essence, except for Quebec. Much of the manning of Canada, as we discussed only last night, talking about the War of 1812, was American immigration. Not merely the loyalists at the time of the Revolution, but American immigrants who went north afterwards because they had a gift of land from the emerging government of what became the province of Ontario. But so the men of power and the men who, after all, our first president was also our military commander. But they did not turn the way, they didn't turn to blood the way the French did. They didn't turn to blood the way the Soviets did. They didn't turn to bloody mess and destructiveness of their own people the way the Iranian elite has done. Why didn't we?
Well, because it wasn't about anything but driving out the foreign ruler.
And the loyalists who chose to get out.
And the loyalists who chose to get
they
out.
They were a large number.
Yeah, they were.
So they purged the nation by their immigration, which is probably a gift.
But what they didn't do is decide, well, we're going to abolish the aristocracy, or we're going to abolish, we're going to change so that the society is unrecognizably different. That was never the point.
They didn't pull down the elite, but there was already an elite.
And the elite took over. I mean, yeah, Washington, exactly. Jefferson were the elite.
Yeah.
And Adams, right?
Fascinating stuff. Yeah. We pause. The last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and to the email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Messrs. Morson, Abbott, and Sodry. Gentlemen, let me read you an email which has come from a town that suddenly is a little bit more significant, Janesville, Wisconsin, from which the Republican nominee for the vice presidency has come. Do any of your guests see the seeds or early signs of another revolution in the United States? There has been, in my mind at least, a growing dissatisfaction with and lack of confidence in both major political parties in this country. The middle class is being economically squeezed into the lower class, and the haves are taking a larger percentage of the economic pie. Federal and state governments are getting deeper into debt and reducing services. That's as far as Kevin from Janesville, Wisconsin goes. He could have written as a final sentence, is it therefore not inevitable that we shall have a revolution because of all of this social injustice and of all of this economic suffering? Do any of you think that would be an inevitable consequence? Surely I don't.
Well, no, I think none of us would say that anything is inevitable.
All right.
But I would concur with his observations as to the growing dysfunctionality of America's political system.
But what is to come of that? What would one predict?
Well, that's for us to determine.
Possibly the election of the other party, of a president and Congress representing the other party.
I think it's entirely unlikely that we will have a revolution. All that will happen will need to happen in America, which is based on the best aspect of the American system, is its reversibility. If enough people care about their situation, there is a system in place where they can change.
Democracy is self-healing, or potentially self-healing.
Exactly.
That was my point earlier.
When things are going well, people become apathetic. When things become bad, people will rise and vote, throw the bombs out. And, of course, there is no need for a revolution.
In the Great Depression, we had 25 to 30% unemployment. Now we have 8% unemployment. We have a gross domestic GDP, which is rising slowly, but rising. This doesn't strike me as a revolutionary situation. I mean, you know, it's not everything we would want, perhaps, but it hardly is even catastrophic by American standards, right? I mean,
why did we not have a revolutionary response to the Great Depression?
I guess people had faith in
yes.
For example, in the charisma of Roosevelt at that point.
E.A. Forster, the British novelist, wrote a book of essays once, which he titled, as I remember, Two Cheers for Democracy. It has tremendous fallibility, and it's often very inefficient. But basically, it is self-healing.
It's the best system that we have, the best of all possible systems that we have. And the best thing about American democracy, which is the first democracy in the world, is the very fact that it can be reversed. When things are good, people become apathetic. But once you step on their tails, people will rise up and vote. And when they use their votes, there is no need for a revolution.
Just now
they change the system the way they want.
Seeking an aphorism, and Gary has a wonderful book about aphorisms, which we've discussed. You could have said, quoting Churchill, if I have this correct, you will know the exact wording, I guess, Gary, democracy is the worst possible mode of government except for all the others.
Except when you consider the alternatives. Yes. Yeah. Right.
I'm happy, Gary, that was not a false quotation.
So far as I know, it's not a false quotation. But most of them turn out to be kind of loose paraphrases.
We will go to the next caller. That next caller is George. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Thank you. Interesting discussion tonight. I was just going to...
In what way is this night different from all other nights?
not really. I was going to particularly raise a point about the American Revolution, whether it was in fact revolutionary. And I would point out that you have to compare basically a revolution against what it revolts against. If you look at the British government, the British government was an oligarchy. Not only was the House of Lords responsible to property, not people, but the House of Commons is every bit as much, particularly as illustrated by the burgage boroughs, where a person can actually own a seat in Parliament, as William Pitt's grandfather did to avoid being prosecuted for stealing diamonds in India. So when the king got that famous John Hancock signature on the Declaration of Independence, where it talks about government deriving its powers from the consent of the governed rather than from the consent of the property, I would suggest that that was an incredibly revolutionary event compared with the nation that we're revolting against. I did have a couple of other points. One was that as far as the religion aspect, the fact was that for people who were in the southern states, particularly people who were active in politics, they were literally at war with their church. If they were in the House of Burgesses, they had to take an oath that they had had communion at an Anglican church within the past year. And their church, of course, the Church of England, which was the established church, they were at war with. So that's kind of an interesting dimension to what their actual religious feelings were. And one other little thing is, of course, one thing is I think maybe the American Revolution offended its critics by being successful. 20 years after the Declaration of Independence, we had a functioning democracy, admittedly part of it indirect election for Senate and President as opposed to direct election, but democracy was certainly a part of it. And 20 years after the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the French were under an emperor whose power was probably every bit as despotic, if not much more so, than Louis XVI had ever hoped for. in many ways, the American Revolution did have some social changes. North of Maryland, admittedly, slavery was not critical to the economies in those states now. But all the states over north of Maryland did abolish slavery, and also the established church was done away with, as well as primogeniture. So there were some actual social changes as well, but I think just the fact of the changed government being responsible to people rather than property was an incredibly radical idea. Given,
didn't we have property qualifications for voting in most states after the revolution? I don't recall that being abolished right away.
We had property qualifications for voting in seven of the colonies. Six of them had no property qualifications. Really restrictive qualifications tended not to be property, but religious. In the Puritan colonies, you had to be a member of the Congregational Church, and that was considerably more of a problem.
You know, I can't resist asking you, because you are clearly very well informed on historical detail. Are you a professional?
Yes, I teach at a community college, but actually...
You teach American history?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I'm a retired lawyer. So,
wonderful.
I wanted to do some work that was fun.
Well, these have been most interesting comments.
Yes,
time is quite short, but let's see if there are any other responses.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I'll listen to it on the radio. Thank you very much.
I quite agree with you. I think the American Revolution, I follow Hannah Arendt in believing that the American Revolution not only was a revolution, it was a revolution par excellence, partly because it was not based on the question of bread and economics. It was based on ideas, and it was successful. And right now we live in a system that was devised by the founding fathers and put into effect by that revolution.
Well, we have come almost to the end of the available time. What important question concerning revolution did we not address tonight?
Well, we didn't talk about the revolutions in Asia.
We're not going to do so now, but this may well be the basis for another program.
And whether that has whether cultural differences of different peoples makes a difference.
Do you have the Chinese Revolution in mind particularly?
Yeah, the Chinese Revolution in particular. But do the fact that, you know, the cultures are different make a difference to the outcome?
Yeah.
Maybe the difference between the Russian and the American or the French case was the native culture made a difference. That's a question to
ask. So that would require a sort of an anthropology of revolution.
Yeah.
We indeed are approaching the end of the available time. My guests have been Gary Saul Morrison, professor of Slavic language and literatures at Northwestern, John Abbott, professor of history at University of Illinois, Chicago, Ahmad Sadri, professor of Islamic world studies and of sociology at Lake Forest College. What is to come? We've got a very interesting program coming up this Sunday when we'll be back, and find programs for all the rest of the week. On Sunday, I'll be talking to a man who is reputedly the expert on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, and his view is that they did not get it on together. And he's got close evidence to that effect. He is, in fact, an historian of considerable established credentiality, so to speak. Monday night, I'll be talking with John Fund from the Republican Convention. John Fund is a guardian of the sacred American electoral right and is quite convinced that there's much voter fraud, which has marked recent elections. And he's got a new book specifying the extent of that and suggesting some possible modes of correction. Those are and other interesting programs, including, of course, at the end of the week, a full evaluation of what happened at the Republican Convention. For now, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.